Hope everybody's having a good April, a good spring. Taxes are due pretty quick. So that's always fun. I don't like spring in Colorado. We get a lot of wind. We get a lot of cold. We get a lot of snow. We get a lot of bipolar weather where it's nice one day and it teases you, and then the next day it's just windy and cold and tumbleweeds are everywhere. And so anyway, not liking the weather, but I'm just giving people some time to jump on. Want to make sure that I'm actually streaming this correctly. So yeah, looks like I'm on there. And I'm on there. Okay. So let's talk about today. So solar eclipse is coming up, April 8th. If, you have any concerns about that, if you think it's a sign from God of coming judgment, end of times, coming of Jesus Christ, whatever, I would encourage you to join the New Day Global Group. It's a private group if you haven't, because I addressed that in my last video on, from that. So, hey Les, good to see you, man. I was just thinking about you the other day, to be honest. Good morning to you. So, I want to talk about, so in light of the eclipse and thinking about what I wanted to talk about today, I wanted to return to some topics that I talk about quite a bit. And I try to bring some common sense and rational thinking to these topics and subjects. And that's the topic of the invisible world, the unseen world, the unseen realms, the deeper levels and layers of creation, the deeper levels and layers of reality that philosophers in the Western world have talked about. This goes back all the way back to ancient Egypt, ancient Greek philosophy, and a spiritual current, if you will, that runs through the West primarily. It's different than Eastern philosophies, but got eradicated, buried over, lost to a lot of the Western mind and the Western consciousness because of Christianity, especially because of Roman Catholic Orthodox Christianity. And so I enjoy talking about that stuff. And I also want to come back and talk about something I talk about quite a bit, which is the left-hand path of spiritual experience and the right-hand path of spiritual experience, or the sun and the moon. So I thought with the eclipse coming and what it could represent to us symbolically and spiritually, if we choose to look at it from that perspective, the balancing of light and dark energies, the balancing of day and night, the bringing of the two together, the aligning of light and darkness, or the left-hand path and the right-hand path. So for those that I've already confused, bear with me and stay with me. Let me start with the self. Because in a lot of Eastern traditions, Vedic writings, at least as far as I understand them, there is this concept of no self, that there really is no self there. And pretty much every spiritual teaching or path outside of Christian dogma, outside of religion, that I've encountered, like in the New Age movement, pretty much imports a lot of Eastern thought and Eastern philosophy into it, including this concept of there being no self in there, of everything about us basically just being a programming, a pattern, everything about us being ego. And some of the goals of meditation, like Zen meditation or sorry, the terms just evade me at the moment. A lot of mystical prayer in the West, contemplative prayer. The idea is to sort of shed the ego, sort of peel it back like an onion, till we get to the realization that there is no self. When we get to the realization that there is no self, then we realize that the self is an illusion, and so everything that the self attaches to is an illusion, which is the Eastern concept of Maya, Maya meaning illusion, and that we discover the core truth, or that we reach enlightenment, or we reach awakening by realizing there is no self in there, and we just are able to let go of everything that the self is attached to. And when we realize there is no self, and we let go of those attachments, then we, as far as I understand it, we end suffering. Because after all, how can you suffer if there's no self in there to suffer with? And you sort of join this union place, this place of where you experience that everything is basically nothing. That everything is one. And then of course, in the East, and remember, these philosophies, much like Christianity, although older than Christianity, developed in completely different cultures, in completely different time periods, and have evolved and grown over time, or have shape-shifted to fit modern life and modern reality. But, and sometimes when that happens, certain practices, certain ideas, this idea of, you know, letting go and there being no self and letting go of all of attachments and just experiencing this oneness and all this stuff, entering the void, so to speak. From the East, you have to remember that life was miserable thousands of years ago. Life was horrible thousands of years ago. I mean, there weren't the modern creature comforts. There certainly wasn't any kind of equality for people. You were certainly born into whatever you were born into, both East and West, right? You were born into royalty. You were born into privilege or higher classes, that were better off with, in terms of resources, or you were born into, and the vast majority of people were born into these lower level areas. So children died, people died. There was lots of disease and suffering. And like I said, no creature comforts and stuff like that. So this idea of getting out of here, this idea of reincarnation, which was part of Hinduism, right? The idea of reincarnation, the idea of karma, all of that stuff. So the idea was that if we can let go of our attachments, that what brings us back is our karma. So either our attachments to things, or things that we did that we need to rectify, or we need to make right, or we need to learn from in the next life. So if we can purge all of our karma and we can let go of all of our attachments, then we won't have to keep coming back in the cycle of death and rebirth into the earth. And so really it was kind of a way of escaping or getting out of hell. And so that was kind of the idea. So you have these, specifically like sort of monastic type of things that you see in the East, definitely, where there's a renunciation of wealth, a renunciation of material things, renunciation of self, and we go off where we don't have those attachments and we try to reach the void, because if we can reach the void before we die, then the belief is that we're not going to come back. So that's how I understand that. Now, again, that's the ancient roots of it, the ancient understandings of it, and very, very simplified. But it's the idea that there is no self. And so you see this in a lot of spiritual teaching. Everything is ego. You have to let go of the ego. You have to, you know, release the ego. You have to release attachments. You have to realize there's no self. And once you do that, you end suffering. The West, Western philosophy, the way it has differed from Eastern philosophies is that in the East, to a large degree, the collective was what was important. The community was what was important. You see that in the culture, at least the times that I've been over there. Although the West is really taking, Western way of thinking and way of the world is really ubiquitous. It's kind of taken over everywhere. In the West, there was more this concept of a self, the concept of a soul. And that soul would reincarnate as well. But you definitely had this idea of a soul, which comes from the Egyptians. It doesn't come from the Christians. It doesn't come from the Bible. It comes from ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. Egyptian, you could say maybe the oldest religion in the world, right? The Egyptian Empire. And that's why they, you know, mummified bodies and buried them with things. And a lot of emphasis was on the crystallization of a self, the holding onto a self that transcends this physical life and then moves into the afterlife. Crystallized, right? And that would be a soul. Now, later comes this idea of reincarnation and stuff like that. I don't want to get too complicated with it today. I just want to say that one of the primary differences when I do comparison between what I understand of Eastern spiritual traditions and Western spiritual traditions, which I have immersed myself in, that's the biggest difference that I see. With the exception of Christian mysticism. In other words, when you go back and you read the early Christian mystics from the 4th century, or you definitely read a lot of the Catholic mystics, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, there are some similarities in the way they would talk about, maybe using different words, but they would talk about the ego, or they would talk about the self being sort of an illusion, or the self is something not to be clung, not to be held onto, not to cling to, the way of the cross, via negativa, it is called in the West. It's a way of finding union with God by negation. So I get to the truth about who God is by negating who God is not. I get to the truth about myself as negating by negating via negating myself. So again, there's a lot of letting go of attachments. There's a lot of similarities. And the idea is to reach this union with the Trinity, with Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or to reach unity between the soul and the Godhead. But even in the mystical traditions of the West, it's not a complete dissolution of the self, a complete dissolving of the self. It's a dissolving of the false self, that's how they would say it. But again, it involves, you know, renunciation of earthly things, renunciation of wealth. Certainly there's a lot of renunciation of sexuality, any types of pleasure, fasting. And in the most extreme cases, you got into like flagellation, where they would, you know, inflict harm on themselves, do self-harm in order to get over guilt in order to get over shame. What the idea and the concept and the pursuit of a right-hand path of spirituality and a left-hand path of spirituality is very ancient and very Eastern. So it is a bit of an import when we talk about right-hand path, left-hand path in the context of modern Western spirituality, or in the context of today, we are importing something from way back. So the right-hand path correlates with the sun, light, day, fire, burning up, an ascension, really sort of metaphorically into the sun, where the self is completely burned up and dissolved, and there is nothing left, and you join oneness with the universe. So you don't have an isolate consciousness. You have a shared consciousness with everything. That's the right-hand path of spirituality. It's very community-oriented. It's very service-oriented. It's very service-to-others-oriented, stuff like that. The left-hand path corresponds with night. It corresponds with darkness. It corresponds with the moon. Now, you still have light in the darkness at night. You just don't have a singular light. You have multifaceted lights. You have the moon, for instance. You have the planets or the moving stars that are visible to the naked eye. And then you have strips of the galaxy. You have what we call falling stars, objects moving through space. And you have the stars that are fixed, right? You have the constellations. There's, you know, ancient people would tell stories out of these constellations. They viewed them as gods and things of this nature. So the idea of the left-hand path then is not that we release everything and move up or ascend, if you will, spiritually in through the sun so that we're burned up and consumed. The idea is that we are all stars with a certain path, with a certain trajectory, with a certain radiance of light that is crystallized in us. It's still light. So it's not that it's not light. You know what I mean? It's not that it's something completely other. It's just that it's not one light like you have during the day. So your monotheistic religions are solar paths and right-hand paths. A lot of your polytheistic religions, where they believe in many gods, correlate with nighttime. Don't always correlate with the left-hand path. Now, here's what's interesting about the left-hand path. Originally in the East, the left-hand path was associated with breaking every social and moral taboo in the community and in the culture. So they would go hang out in graveyards. They would engage in all kinds of taboo sexual activities and orgies, and some of the tantric sex stuff from the East comes from the left-hand path. They would eat disgusting food. Just trying to break every taboo out there possible. And so they were perceived, especially by those on the right-hand path, and especially those with no understanding of what was actually the spiritual practice of the left-hand path, they were perceived as being very, very evil, and they were vilified, right? Now, the truth is that the people who would choose a left-hand path were radically trying to break with the illusion, with Maya. They were radically trying to break with their own ego. They weren't doing this for self-aggrandizement. So take sexuality, for example. Part of breaking the taboo would not be just going and getting your friends together that you all find attractive and wonderful and beautiful and having this, you know, tremendous sex party where you were being self-indulgent. The idea was to go out and find people that you thought were disgusting. And if you could, right, because physical attraction, beauty, sexuality goes together in Maya, in the constructs. So in order to break that, you do the taboo, you do the opposite. You would engage in sexual activity and activities with people that you found gross and disgusting, basically. And all of that was meant to break down the self. So how did any of that, really any of this, get into Western thought and Western thinking? How did these Eastern, was it just that these, gurus came over from the East, like, like Yogananda, and I can't remember some of the other guys that came over. He's the only one I can think of right off the top of my head. Came to America, came to the West and said it's time for these teachings. It's not really what happened. You have to go back to the Theosophical Society. I'm laughing because I can't even remember the name of the lady that started the Theosophical Society. If somebody knows it, put it in here. Madame Blavatsky, Helena Blavatsky, who was a Russian lady who was a part of the Russian Orthodox faith. And at some point she travels to India, she travels to Egypt, and she's given what she refers to as the secret doctrine. And she comes back and establishes the Theosophical Society. And this was, I want to say, mid to late 1800s. I might have the time frame a little bit wrong, but let's say somewhere between 1870 and 1900 and something. The Theosophical Society took off. It was a spiritual awakening in the West, particularly among the higher classes, the more affluent people who didn't have to spend all their time, you know, working in the factories and stuff, but could spend time thinking about these things and stuff like that. So the teachings of Madame Blavatsky infused Western society with a real revival of spirituality, a real awakening of stuff. And most of what, or a lot, at least a lot of what is taught in any form, fashion, in spiritual circles or from spiritual teachers today that are not, you know, embracing Christianity, there are remnants, at least remnants of Madame Blavatsky's influence and Madame Blavatsky's teachings. And so Madame Blavatsky introduced to the West the concept of the right-hand path and the left-hand path. And Madame Blavatsky was teaching a right-hand path. And she said that the left-hand path was evil. That the left-hand path was self-indulgent. And you see these two things sort of grow up within American culture, within American society. But most people don't know about this because they just, why would they know about this, I guess? Why would they educate themselves about this? Most people think that, you know, in the West, there's Christianity and atheism. That's it. There's religion and atheism. That's it. That's not true. There have been many, many, many spiritual awakenings throughout American history that had absolutely nothing to do with religion at all. And while I would argue that theosophy can and does have religious elements to it, it very much takes almost like a scientific approach to the study of paranormal experiences, spirituality, God, and stuff like that. So you have a lot of things that took place in the 20th century that was impacting the psyche and the soul of the West that had very little or nothing to do with Christianity. And the Theosophical Society, Theosophy, the teachings of the Secret Doctrine, the teaching of Madame Blavatsky probably impacted as much or more than anybody. But she did talk about this left-hand path thing. And that was also seeded into American culture. And it was really fostered in certain occult groups as a form of Satanism. Now, I almost hate to even use that word because it's probably going to get me pulled down or something, cause me problems, because there was, you know, this satanic panic back in the late 80s, early 90s, and we're seeing a revival of satanic panic today. But anybody who practices, who is a practicing on that, under that heading, they're not all atheists. That's just complete bullshit. That's complete bullshit. When people say, Satanists don't believe in Satan, they're all just atheists. Well, that may be the Anton LaVey stream. But there's also the Michael Aquino stream. Michael Aquino, I think, either edited or put together, wrote, was very, very involved with Anton LaVey and the production of the Satanic Bible. And then he broke off and started his own occult group called the Temple of Set. Set being the ancient Egyptian version of Satan. And he's just one example of that. It's the one that comes to mind because it's the most prominent. So there are streams, the most public streams of Satanism. They don't believe in God. They're atheists. They basically have the philosophy of Ayn Rand and practice that. Good for them. That's who you see out in the public. The rest of these groups are not as much public because they're not trying to recruit members. You have Michael W. Ford, who I can't remember the name of his society, but he's another example of Satanists and practitioners who definitely engage purposely with demonic spirits, demonic archetypes, ancient gods and goddesses, teach things like astral projection, do things like tarot card readings, and are using these archetypes, these what we might call darker energies, what in some cases maybe even evil spirits, for the enhancement of the self, for the growth of the self, for the advancement of the self. Stephen Flowers is another one out there. He's mostly known for his work on Nordic magic and the runes and stuff like that. Stephen Flowers is another one out there. And Stephen Flowers has even written a book called The Lords of the Left-Hand Path. And interestingly enough, and this was after I was teaching this stuff, so I didn't get this from Stephen Flowers, but I was saying that Jesus was modeling a left-hand path of spirituality in certain places in the Gospels. And teaching a left-hand path of spirituality, definitely in certain places and certain aspects of the story. And from Dr. Flowers' perspective, he also said the same thing about Jesus, that he was one of the lords of the left-hand path. He gives a certain criteria, and in order to be a lord of the left-hand path, in order to be fully actualized along the left-hand path, he said that there needed to be the development of self, the development of the will, definitely breaking societal taboos, as long as you weren't breaking the law, and engaging with dark, you know, engaging with the adversary in the story. In other words, Satan, Lucifer, Beelzebub, any adversarial being that you read about within Western, in the Bible, you have to be all about that. Now, Joseph Campbell, some of you may or may not be familiar with Joseph Campbell. I hope this is okay. I hope I'm not just like rambling and losing everybody. I really am. This is just the introduction. I'll finish it here in about 3 minutes. Joseph Campbell talks about the left-hand path, and he talks about being able, the left-hand path in this way. He says, being able to find your own bliss in, let's see, being able to find your own bliss, even if it does not meet the criteria and standards of the society or the family that you're living in. So, for example, most of us that are my age, and maybe this still goes on, I think this definitely probably happened with millennials. I don't know if it's happening as much with Gen Z and my kids' generation, which I think they're calling Gen Alpha now. You had a checklist. I definitely had a checklist. You know, this is how you do life. And there were certain things that were absolutely set in stone. Number one, you do well in school. You follow the rules. You don't get in trouble. You don't get detention. You don't get suspended. You stay away from drugs and alcohol, and you graduate from high school. Check. You try to excel at something so you can get a scholarship, because the goal of graduating from high school is not to get a job. It's to go on to college. So you go on to college. Check. Then the next thing is you find a spouse while in college. You find someone to marry, because the expectation is that you'd be married by the time you were out of college. Check. Then the next thing you do is you get a career. Check. And then you buy a house. Check. And then you have kids. Check. And then you have grandkids. Check. And that, and you stay married to the same person the rest of your life, because you took those vows and whatever. And you go to church on Sundays, and we believe these things, and we follow these, this political party, and you just check, 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 right? And we all just kind of mindlessly, at least I think for a lot of us, we just kind of mindlessly fell into that space and fell into that place with no exercise of freedom at all, no exercise of free will at all, to break any of those, to miss something on the checkmark. And if you missed something on the checkmark, you felt like there was something wrong with you. If you missed something on the checkmark, you felt like you somehow really sort of screwed the pooch, right? Like messed up. And then years later, you know, you find out, well, I married the wrong person, or I'm in the wrong career, or none of this, you know, really is working for me and making me happy. So Joseph Campbell's idea of the left-hand path was that you find your own bliss, find what brings you happiness at the expense of what's on the list. Now, if what brings you joy and what brings you happiness is on the list, and there are people like that. There are people that they're just happy to check the list, completely did it correctly and have bliss, right? But that doesn't mean that that's the right path for all of us. And so the idea is, on the left-hand path, is to find and develop a self. So the right-hand path is to renounce, lose the self, get rid of the self. The left-hand path is to find and develop a self. Now, Madame Blavatsky said the left-hand path was evil, but it doesn't have to be evil, and it doesn't have to include things that go against your morals or your values. In fact, that wouldn't be a left-hand path. That would be a right-hand path that is masquerading as a left-hand path. So in other words, if I went out and joined one of these organizations and they actually believed in a literal devil and a literal Satan and a literal Lucifer, literal Beelzebub, whatever, and they were worshiping these entities, and I was required to do something that violates my core values in order to be in the group, whether it's some kind of taboo sex or whether it's something else, then by defiling by violating my values, I am practicing a principle of the right-hand path, which says I renounce what's authentic and true to me in order for the groupthink, in order to fit into the group, in order to belong. So then it's no longer a left-hand path. This isn't the same as the left-hand path from the East, where you're doing those things on purpose in order to destroy the self. And those things would be very destructive to the self. Even from a psychological perspective, it would be very destructive to the self. Now, we're living in a time, so then that begs the question, is there a self? Like, what's the point of following a left-handed path orientation of spirituality or philosophy of life? What's the point of doing that if there really is no self? And so the argument goes like this, you know, everything that you know and understand about yourself in this world is part of this temporary world. It's part of this temporary existence. Every aspect of yourself that you experience, in other words, every role, every persona that you play of yourself is temporary. I'm a husband and a father. I wasn't always a husband and a father. You may be a wife and a mother, but you weren't always a wife and a mother. I was a pastor, but I'm no longer a pastor, so I wasn't always a pastor. So I can't attach eternal identity to anything about me that I only experience on the temporal plane or in this physical life, because the truth is that someday I won't be here anymore, right? We don't like to think about that. We don't like to talk about that, but we're all, one day we're going to die. And then who are we when we die? And see, that's the question. Is there a soul? Is there an identity that remains intact after death, or is there not? Let me just say that atheism can be very attractive and freeing and helpful for people who have especially grown up under fundamentalism or have just generally and innately a fear of death. Because the good news is there's nothing there. There is just this biological existence. The good news, there is no judgment. There is no, the good news is there is nothing after. So there's nothing to be afraid of. There is no self that has to navigate something that we know nothing about and something that might be very scary. There is no self to meet a God in judgment or meet a void or meet karma or meet the lords of karma, which the Theosophical Society talks about, that evaluates your life and judges your life and chooses your next life path for you. So atheism can be very freeing as a philosophy in and of itself. Scientific materialism can be appealing at an emotional level because it delivers people from the fear of death. Walking a path where you let go of a religion that promises you heaven and you don't embrace atheism or anti-theism that says there is no God, or that you embrace something that says, I believe there is a self. I believe there is an invisible world. I believe there is a creator. I believe there is a source. but it's not like what the Bible said. That can become, that actually might be the most terrifying proposition. I don't know. So in the Western teachings, Western philosophies, Western occult teachings, and in the church, there is a soul. There is a person in there. So I just want to spend the next few minutes here making a case for a self, for an existence before this life and an existence after this life. Now, how am I going to do that? Because I can't prove it. And I also want to just, you know, think about this concept that there are levels and layers to reality and to creation that are thought forms in the mind of God. That's how I heard one teacher recently refer to them, and I liked that, that are supporting us, this is what I believe, are supporting us on our journey, spiritual and human, and supporting us on our spiritual evolution, that are helping us grow. In other words, this identity, this being, just because I can't eternally know myself as Aaron Tomlinson, because I will not eternally be in this form, does not negate in any way, shape, or form, logically or philosophically. It in no way logically or philosophically negates that there can be a self. In fact, I would argue that the one thing that is absolutely constant for me and you that we both share in common that gives us a strong indication within our own experience that there is a self, before I get into the other stuff, is that one thing that has always been constant was that you were a singular point of consciousness, a singular point of awareness who experienced all those iterations and versions of yourself. Here's what I mean by that. I don't want that to be too complicated. Why am I me and you are you in terms of our consciousness? Why can I only know what you're thinking and feeling if you self-report it and you self-report it accurately for the most part? Right? Why can't I get away from myself? If there is no self there, why can't I get away from myself? Why do I still experience? Why do I still wake up in the morning as me? As a singular point of consciousness that has to self-report what it was like to be a pastor, that has to self-report or can self-report what it was like before I was a husband, or what it was like before I was a father, or what it was like before I was in my 50s. There is a self there. It's self-evident. It's the experiencer who's had all of those experiences. And the question becomes, does that experiencer have any meaning? Does that experiencer have any existence after this life? If there are layers of nature, layers of reality, aspects of the universe. This is what the Western spiritual tradition teaches. That are immaterial. Some of which, most of which, at least with the technology that we have today, cannot be seen. And some of which cannot be measured because it exists outside of time and space. And I'm not that far off of where quantum physics is, for those of you that are really scientifically minded. That's something that's been part of Western tradition, Western spiritual tradition, going all the way back to the Egyptians. Centuries. It's just been lost to a large degree, especially those of us that were immersed in church experience or materialism, just chasing the almighty dollar. There's a very rich spiritual tradition. We don't have to go to the East. There's a very profound spiritual tradition in the West that has come down to us. Nothing wrong with going into the East. I'm not saying there is. I'm just saying it's sad that so many look there when we have our own tradition, which may even predate the Eastern philosophies, and people don't know about it. So that's what I'm trying to do, is raise awareness of this. So the occult teachings, the spiritual teachings, the Western spiritual teachings say there are layers of reality that are thought forms in the mind of God that carry a polarity, that carry a polarity, and ultimately forms its highest apex in physical reality here on Earth and in all that is here that we get to see and observe and measure and science gets to study and all of that stuff. It's not a lower form. It's actually the terminus of the mind of God. And then we incarnate as souls. We incarnate in various different incarnations and bodies and experiences for the purpose of growing and expanding that center point of consciousness that you are. And that there is a higher self that exists. And the higher self isn't like a detached self that sits up in heaven someplace. The higher self is a space, is a place inside our own consciousness where we transcend, listen to this very closely, we transcend the dissociative boundaries of past lives. In other words, there's a space in our consciousness where we can go back and recall stuff from past lives, but we're dissociated from them, so we do not remember them. The higher self transcends all of those spaces and basically collects all of that data and then is really the unseen hand or guide in our lives that we call God or that we call the Holy Spirit. That's what I think. That's what I believe. But in Western tradition, there are also angelic beings and archangels who are vibrational patterns or thought forms in the mind of God that interact with us and that support us and that help us. So Aaron, that's all great, but how do you know? Like, this is just speculation. See, this is what I get all the time. This is just speculation. This is just people's opinion. We don't really know. It, prove it to me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Always met with skepticism first. Always met with skepticism first, unless I talk to somebody who is just wildly into spirituality. I find that interesting. It's always met with skepticism first. The burden of proof is always on you. And I get that, and that's fine. But let's just look at some things that we can look at, that everybody can research, and you can decide for yourself. I realized very early on with my child, before they could even speak, just intuitively, but then observing and watching for these patterns to develop and emerge, that there are things about my son that are unique and innate to him. Not things that we taught him, not things that we shaped or formed him to be, but things that were innate to him. He has an innate intuition. He has an innate sensitivity to spiritual things. And it, when that began to show up, we began to encourage it. I remember one time there was no rain in the weather, and we had something planned. And it's amazing to me that there was no rain in the weather with all the modern stuff, but it was going to be partly cloudy or something. I can't remember. And he said, we can't, and he's like barely three at the time. He says, we can't do the picnic today or the outing today, whatever we're going to do, because it's going to rain. It's going to be rained out. And we said, oh, it's not supposed to rain. Who told you it was going to rain, buddy? And he said, the birds told me. And then sure enough, it was rained out. It didn't happen. That was the first like key. And then there were times that he encountered poltergeists. There were times that he encountered, departed people, members of my family that he didn't know or he'd never talked about. And he was able to come back and tell me specific information about those departed family members. Encounters with angels and things like that. I had a lot of those things myself, so it wasn't met with skepticism. So we encouraged that. And the more that we encouraged that, the more that that grew. My other son, he has his own spiritual strengths and his own other wonderful qualities, but they manifest in a more physically oriented thing. In other words, he wants to be an engineer. He wants to go into coding. He wants to do these kinds of things. But these things are emerging naturally. What do you do with somebody who just has a natural musical ability? I've known people like that. They can just pick up any instrument and they can play by ear because they just have such a gift for music. What do you do with somebody that is just very physically gifted as an athlete? In other words, we do have things that are innately us. I mean, like physical ability is going to wane with time, but in the same way, let me give you an example to explain what I'm saying a center point of consciousness. One of my sons has a lot of athletic ability, really does, really good body control, always has. Didn't have to teach him how to ride a bike at all. It was amazing to me. I was going out there, going to be dad. He hopped on the bike, and he just took off around the block. Perfect balance, never crashed, just boom, like that. Got really good body control, really good athletic abilities. So he may become really good at his sport of choice, right? Or he may play football in the fall, basketball in the winter, and run track in the spring, and then maybe swim in the summer and be good at all of them. But it's because the athlete part of him remains. He may go on to do something in college. He may go on and then after college decide he wants to pick up and play golf. And he'd be really good at golf. And then those skills may decline, but, you know, guaranteed, he's still going to be good at it because it's innately part of him. So it's the same way, center point of consciousness. You see what I'm saying? Whether you're husband, wife, doctor, work, coworker, boss, employee, whatever. You see? So people have, so if there is no self, then where do those things come from? Where do certain personality traits come from? Where do certain temperaments come from? It's not all programming. It's not all illusion. It's not. And so I think those are some basic things that we can look at and say, yeah, I do have a self in here. I do have preferences. Why do certain people like certain foods and other people don't like those or like certain movies? And you see what I'm saying? All of this temperament, personality stuff. Yes, it's influence. Yes, it's shaped. Yes, it's formed. Yes, we can have programming. Yes, we can become too attached to these things and it can create for us needless suffering. And yes, by practicing letting go of some of this stuff and learning some humility in certain areas can go a long way towards giving us peace and making us happy, but it doesn't mean there is no self. So that's the first thing I would look at. The second thing I would look at is the consistency in the pattern of near-death experience. Not everybody who dies and comes back to life, in fact, it's not even the majority, has a near-death experience. Or do they? I'll come back to that in a second. But those that do, there's a fairly consistent pattern of reporting about that type of experience. Now, there may be differences in the information that they bring back in terms of the meaning of life and this, that, and the other thing. But I think there is enough evidence for that. I think there has been enough, a sufficient number of case studies done on people who have recalled past lives and as children, and the facts that they are able to give about their past lives are then able to be verified factually about a person who died, about relatives, about being able to identify relatives. There's been a lot of studies done on that. And I think there's enough there for me to say, I think we have enough indicators scientifically of past lives. And if we have past lives, there's a good chance we have future lives. I think we have enough evidence on near-death experiences that are consistent. And I said, not everybody who dies has a near-death experience. Did you know that you dream almost every single night? When you go into REM sleep, which you're not really getting sleep if you're not getting into REM sleep. If you go into REM sleep, you are dreaming. Yet there are people who will swear they never dream at night. It's not that they don't dream. It's that by the time they wake up and come into their waking consciousness, their ordinary waking consciousness, they've completely blacked out the dream. It is very possible for you to black out memories. People do this under the influence of drugs or alcohol, where they black out. People have a severe traumatic experience, like a car accident, and the only thing they can remember is getting on the highway that day. People have traumatic memories from childhood that, or as an adult, that they have blacked out, that they have completely dissociated from and forgotten. So just because the vast majority, let's say, of people, I don't know the actual numbers, but let's say the vast majority of people who have near-death experiences don't report anything, doesn't mean they didn't have the experience. It could be just as likely that they had the experience, but it was so far outside their waking reality, and they were in such a state of trauma from whatever was causing the near-death experience that they simply don't remember that they had a near-death experience. I think that's probably the most likely scenario. Now, I definitely have a bias. Great. Aaron, why do you have a bias? I'm going to bring this to my last point for all of this. I have a bias because I have experiences with extra-physical, paranormal, supernatural activity of all kinds. And so do millions and millions and millions of other people. And there are consistent reports of ghosts, poltergeists, departed loved ones, psychics, psychic mediums, real ones, not fake ones, real ones that can get in touch and channel information. I know people who can consistently access, by accessing their spirit guides or accessing ancestors or accessing the Archangel Michael or whoever or Christ or whoever they're accessing, can consistently give detailed information to people that they have no way of physically or naturally knowing. They couldn't get it off of Google. They couldn't get it off of social media. Nobody told them about it. And they're not out there trying to make a buck on a stage. They're not out there trying to promote themselves. They get enough clientele. In fact, the people that I know that really have the goods treat them as sacred. In other words, that really have psychic senses and can really deliver the goods, they treat it as sacred, and they don't market it that way. And they still have plenty of people that come to them. So I've worked with several people who've told me things about myself I never told anybody, who during sessions when they were channeling information would talk to me about things I had just put in a journal or a diary or just talked to a close friend about and hadn't shared, hadn't shared with anybody. And then I'll send other people to them, and they'll have the same kinds of experiences. So that information is coming from somewhere. Now, again, this is met with skepticism by people who have not experienced it or don't know people like that. It's just met with skepticism. Well, I don't know about it. Maybe this isn't. Well, I'm not too sure about it. Well, are you sure they're getting it from that, or are they getting it from this other source here? Well, they're the ones that are doing it. I mean, let me put it to you this way. If you can build a car, if you can get all the parts together and you can build a car, and you tell me this part goes here and makes the car work, and this is how the car works, I'm more inclined to believe you than if you've never driven a car, much less ridden in a car, like you've had one or two or three or four experiences with this kind of thing, maybe sort of, that we could kind of explain, but it really seemed to have an impact on my life. So, I'm really skeptical of that stuff. You're not going to tell me how a car works. So why would I believe you and your skepticism when the person who's telling me I'm contacting Archangel Michael, I'm contacting this, I'm receiving a download from however they are intuiting information. And there's tons of ways to do that. And I've done it myself a lot. So why wouldn't I believe them when they say that? Why wouldn't I believe them? They're delivering on the goods. And then lastly, you know, I've had these experiences myself with extra physical beings that have supported me, that have given me wisdom, that have given me insight about the future, that have told me about future things before they were going to happen. A lot of that, I thought at the time, was the Holy Spirit and Jesus, and maybe it was. Maybe it was. And maybe if this person thinks they're getting it from Michael the Archangel, maybe they're not. But I'm still going to lean into their testimony and their experience before I just lean into skepticism for the sake of skepticism by people who have not experienced it. So why don't they have those experiences? Because they do not happen most of the time on their own. They do not happen most of the time on their own. My son has had experiences because he's awake already to sensing those things using non-physical senses and vibrational patterns embedded within his own spiritual energetic body. So if you don't charge spiritually and energetically your spiritual and energetic body, you are not going to have a lot of sensitivity to these things. If you do not learn how to effectively and accurately shift your state of consciousness from physical presence to thought, memory, imagination presence, and really get into what I call the imaginal realm where you can contact, where those beings can make contact with you, where archangels can make contact with you, where angels can make contact with you, where departed loved ones can make contact with you, where ancestors can make contact with you. There's training involved in that. There's effort involved in that. It's a skill. Some people, just like with athletic ability, musical ability, engineering ability, math ability, reading ability, communication ability, that is innately in them, they have, there are some people that just have a more natural inclination to detection of vibrational patterns, thought forms in the mind of God, higher level beings, non-physical beings. They have more attunement to those worlds than others. It does not mean they're making it up. I mean, it's insulting. It's insulting. And this is not that rare. It really isn't. I can count on, I can name off the top of my head 5 or 6 people I know that can accurately tap into information. And if you went to them for reading, it would blow your mind. So, That's my other take. So Aaron, what does this have to do? Let me bring it back. What does this have to do with the right-hand path and left-hand path? Here's what I think. I think that if we want to choose a path of self-renunciation and obedience and service and go through the sun and burn up, I think that's perfectly fine. If that's genuinely your bliss, then in a sense, that is a left-hand path. For me, it's the development of self and the enjoyment of this life that we've come into and learning how to navigate the difficulties and the sufferings and the hardship of it while making contributions to other people along the way. That would be my definition of a left-hand path. Being able to bring together, in other words, I think... excuse me, if there is a goal that is consistent for all of us, I think the purpose is for us to be able to balance polarities, for us to be able to bring polarities and hold them in balance. In other words, imagine a big circle over here that represents the unseen spiritual world, the worlds that I'm talking about, all of that being held inside a vibrational pattern inside this circle over here. And then imagine another circle that represents material reality and all the sciences and all of that stuff is over here. And so you've got spiritual unseen over here, material seen over here, and they're polarities. They are polarities, but they are also polarities that come together. Polarities that come together. And so there's this space where you have both. You have a third thing because you don't have just the polarities. You have the polarities coming together and harmonizing, and that creates, if you do it with circles, that creates in geometry what's known as the Vesica Pisces. The Vesica Pisces is most people know it today as the fish symbol that is used by religious people to identify themselves as Christians. But there is a much deeper meaning to the fish symbol as it relates to the Vesica Pisces and the balancing of the spiritual light energies and the material dark energies and bringing them together to form something that is a third, to hold a balance. And a lot of your ancient Christian art that I think maintained the kernel of the mysteries that are contained within the Christian tradition, the mysteries that were meant to be given to the next, to the age of Pisces, through the teachings of Christ in the West that became distorted and polluted, mostly because it became literally interpreted and a means to power that was abused. But I think it's the word, the consciousness, the logos, the universal mind, and an aspect of that consciousness, the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. I think that's something that's true of all of us. I think that it's learning to balance this human material life with the spiritual and divine life and bringing them together in some kind of a balance. And I do believe that there are entities and angels and beings that help us do that. Now, because I do believe that free will is part of this, free will is very much part of a left-hand path of spirituality. Because I do believe in free will, then you have the choice to move over into one polarity or the other. So when I was in Christianity, I was in the spiritual polarity, very much at the expense of not spending a lot of time in the material plane. Now, when I would spend time in the material plane, I was bringing stuff back from that spiritual realm, and so there was an impact from it. There was a lot of signs and wonders. There were people that had angelic encounters. There was a lot of different stuff that happened, a lot of healing, physical, mental, emotional. But I spent a lot of time over here. I was out of balance, and I lost myself, and it was damaging. On the other side of this are people who go into full materialism, who meet anything from this polarity with skepticism. See, they haven't crossed over. They're not in that Vesica Pisces. They don't have both together in any kind of balance. They're clear over here in materialism. So it becomes about themselves. It becomes about, this is the Ayn Rand path of Satanism. Materialism, acquisition of wealth, acquisition of experiences, what makes me feel good, what my opinion is, et cetera, and so on. And they meet with resistance and skepticism, anybody that's coming from this side over here. And then we could get into talking about how there are Luciferic beings that are so far on the spiritual side of it that they want you to renounce and just come up and hang with them all the time. And then there are what the Rosicrucians call the Arlims, which are the darker entities that I was talking about earlier, that people on the left-hand path of the Michael Aquino, Michael Ford streams are actively engaging with and believe in. So, but it's interesting to me, when we come back to the Vesica Pisces, you see Jesus oftentimes in the center of the Vesica Pisces. I don't think, again, it's about a physical or actual entity, Jesus, I think it is a symbol that is being given to us and embedded in us from the Western spiritual traditions that says this is our purpose. This is the purpose of humanity. The purpose of humanity is to learn to hold space for both of these in attention in order to have love and free will and bring that balance together. And by bringing the polarities together, create a third thing. And once that third thing has been created and then coalesces and crystallizes within us, then I think that we do carry that self into the next stage of spiritual evolution, whatever that may be. And it's probably an endless and infinite stage. So there probably is no end goal. There's just the experiences of this evolving consciousness that some people call God, that some people call Source, that some people call the universe, that some people call the mind of God. It's all semantics. All right. I didn't get a lot of comments, at least that I'm seeing. So I don't know if this resonated with people out there today or didn't resonate with you. I do want to do this kind of content more. I do want to help people. I want to get myself back into that space because if I'm honest with myself, I let the pendulum swing too far over here into the material world. And it needed to for me for a while. I needed to recover and find my humanity. I needed to restore some things about me. I needed to heal from some traumas. I needed to correct some errors in my character that I got from being too much over on this side of things for too long. And the last thing I want to do is bring forth teachings that I haven't, that I don't feel like I've worked out enough in my own life that I can give it away to other people with integrity so that it's helpful for them and supportive to them and not something that becomes hurtful or harmful to them. So let me know if this kind of stuff resonates. A couple comments that I do see. Let's see. Benny's on. Angie came on YouTube. Great. Again, I can't see on Facebook. Just it says Facebook user, which I hate. Joybird says, new here, you just described the source of challenges between me and my adult children. They don't play by the rules, and I think they are important for stability. Yeah, definitely a balance there. Philosophical idealism is likely more correct when it comes to reality than any Eastern philosophy, with possible exception of Taoism. I bet that was Joe Machuda. I agree with you. Makes total sense. I love that definition of the left-hand path. Balancing polarity and rhythm is likely the goal of this physical plane. Love this. I think I'm finding my way back to balance. Very good. Thank you. I missed about 30 minutes. Have to watch replay. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining me. Again, give me some more feedback on this. I think I will engage in the New Day Global group. So if you're not in the Facebook group, the New Day Global private Facebook group, you won't have access to this. It's absolutely free. You just have to agree to the rules and abide by the rules and join the group. And I think I will, because I'm done with my class on Monday nights, I think I will come back on, see who jumps on tomorrow night, like say around 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock Eastern time, and just discuss some of the stuff some more and see where people are at with this. So anyway, love you guys. Thank you for watching this and look forward to more engagement.